Andy, did you want to come up and make that announcement? And then we'll get to groundfish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. I apologize for not being here the other day to give the enforcement report, but I hope everybody got to meet my deputy, Tim Donovan, who's going to be at more council meetings in the future, I think. Yesterday, I received a message that an administrative law judge ruled on the Greg Duckworth case. Mr. Duckworth is a resident of Rhode Island who had a previous administrative penalty that was not paid. He continued to fish and got another permit using some false Coast Guard documentation. It's been about 2.5 years that we've been investigating this, and it's gone through the courts on a number of occasions. However, yesterday the administrative law judge imposed a penalty of $1,040,000 to Mr. Duckworth, revoked his operator permit, and revoked the permits of the fishing vessels Twister, Reaper, and True American. That's all I have. Thanks.
Any questions for Andy? What happens with all that money? And can we get some of it?
Well, first we have to get some of it. And a decision like this is subject to appeal. And if Mr. Duckworth appeals it, it could be a long time.
Okay, thanks.
Did I dodge the issue well enough?
Any questions for Andy? Dave Preble?
Yeah, just a quick one. I got a point of information. During the time of the appeal, assuming he appeals it, during the time of the appeal, are the permit revocations in effect during the appeal? Okay, thank you.
Anything further? Thanks, Andy. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As usual, the Groundfish Committee documents are behind tab number 3. For the discussion today, document number 3, which is the PDT call summary. Document number 4 is the Groundfish AP meeting summary, and number 5 is the recreational AP meeting summary. There's also a document handed out today, but that will be shown as a presentation, so we can discuss that at that time. The committee has not met since the last council meeting. We did have a meeting scheduled for the 29th of September. That meeting was canceled since members of the PDT staff have been working on the interim action and were unable to work on Amendment 16 analysis. So we didn't have anything for the committee to work on. The committee is currently scheduled to have its next meeting on the 30th of October. That's the day before Halloween. Costumes are not required. Although if you show up in one, it's fine unless you show up as Gil the Fish. As noted in the Groundfish Committee materials, the delay in the committee meetings means that the DEIS will not be ready for the November meeting, and a little bit later, staff will go through a look at the revised timeline and where we are. I'm going to first read into the record Recreational Advisory Panel report, and then Maggie Raymond's going to come up and give the Groundfish Advisory Panel report. Barry Gibson, who's the chair of the RAP, had a conflict and not able to make it today, so I will just read the report into the record, and then if there are questions, Tom and I will try and answer them as we were there at that meeting. The recreational advisors met on September 17th to review the GARM 3 assessments and to discuss the recreational commercial allocations, as well as potential management measures for Amendment 16. The management measures agenda item was postponed due to lack of advice from the PDT, which had been working on the groundfish interim action and was therefore unable to address the issue in time for the meeting. Council staff gave a brief overview of the GARM results, and there were a number of items that were discussed by the panel, which can be found in the meeting summary. While exact calculations have not been made, it's expected that recreational allocations will be made only for Gulf of Maine cod, Gulf of Maine haddock, and possibly pollock, based on the proposed criteria that only stocks where the recreational catch is greater than 5% in federal waters will be subject to allocation. Preliminary ranges of mortality reductions are contained in the summary and are based on the timeline, timeframes used either 1996, 2006, or the 2001, 2006 timeline. However, RAP members expressed serious reservations over any further recreational reductions for Gulf of Maine cod. Since Framework 42 target of 32% reduction was actually exceeded by approximately twice that amount. Members felt that this needed to be taken into account for Amendment 16. Regarding the time frame to be used, the RAP reiterated its support for 2001-2006 time frame for determining the allocations between the commercial and recreational components of the fishery for stocks that are subject to an allocation. In addition, to the rationale and justifications offered at the RAP meeting in May, the RAP believes the following justifications further support this time frame. One, stock sizes of Gulf of Maine cod, Gulf of Maine haddock, and pollock were low in the mid-90s, reducing access to these fish for recreational fishermen. Using 2001 as a starting date for the allocation reflects a period when access improved because of rebuilding had begun. Two, the more recent time period is more consistent with current fishery conditions and is more reflective of where the fishery is at present and where it is likely going. The RAP also recommends that in those instances where the recreational harvest is only a small portion of removals, i.e. under 5%, additional management measures, including ACLs and AMs, may not be necessary for the recreational sector. So if there are any questions from the council, I'll try and answer them.
Questions from the council?
Maggie, if you'd like to come up.
Good morning. I was asked by the chair of the advisory panel, Paul Parker, to deliver the report today since he couldn't be here. I am happy to do that, but I will just say at the beginning that I was not anticipating that at the time that I was attending the meeting, so there may be some issues that I'm paid less attention to than others. The advisory panel met, the meeting began with a review of the GARM 3 results, as well as the preliminary PDT work on estimating the rebuilding trajectories and mortality reductions needed. The discussion then turned to the fact that Amendment 16 would be delayed probably until 2010 due to the fact that the PDT members were working on the interim rule. Excuse me. So there are several action items that recommendations that the advisors made, and we would hope that the council would take some action on those recommendations. So the first one was, given the delay in Amendment 16, the advisors feel that it's important for the council to reiterate its to the agency its position on the mitigating measures that it recommended for the interim rule at your last meeting. And in addition to that, the advisors would hope that the council would recommend to the National Marine Fisheries Service that in the interim rule they remove the cap on Days at Sea Leasing. In your correspondence documents, number three is a letter from me to the committee explaining why the cap on days at sea leasing is a problem in because of the differential days at sea counting. This, of course, was not something that was anticipated when the cap on days at sea leasing was put in on Amendment 13, and circumstances have changed considerably since then, and this cap provides a this cap presents a problem for many vessels in obtaining enough days at sea to remain viable. It's also important to keep in mind that the cap, there is no cap on accumulating days at sea through days at sea transfer. So it is possible if you have enough money to stack enough permits, you can get around the cap on days at sea leasing by increasing your days at sea leasing baseline. I went back and looked at Amendment 13 to see what the rationale was for the cap on days at sea leasing, and there's one sentence that says it reduces the possibility that a vessel will accumulate excess days at sea. From an industry perspective, I don't know what excess days at sea would be, but that's certainly not where we are now. The GAP also made a statement that they supported the council's recommendation as a their entire package of recommendations for the interim rule, including the restrictions that were proposed to meet the mortality objectives as well as the mitigating measures. Two members of the GAP did not agree with that recommendation. Then we went back and looked at how the council had reacted to the recommendations that we made from our May meeting. And one issue of great concern that was brought forward by the advisors in the May meeting was the issue of joint liability for sector members. And that the advisors made a recommendation to the committee which would limit that liability, and that the committee agreed with that recommendation, brought it to the council in June, and the council in June tabled that recommendation, and this is what the motion said, until the advisory panel and VMS enforcement committees have a chance to review a list of violations. Well, that, it wasn't clear what that meant, but there was no list of violations provided to the AP at our September meeting to review. So the advisors are reiterating their position from the May meeting that this issue needs to be addressed. And I went back to Amendment 13 to look at the language. And I'm just going to step aside for a minute to pass these this out. But what I'm giving you is two paragraphs. The first one is the actual language from Amendment 13 regarding joint liability for sectors. And the second paragraph is what exists in the current regulations. And you'll see that they're very different, and the advisory panel is very concerned about this issue, and we're hoping that it can be addressed. It would be simply if the council could reiterate its intent that it had with this issue in Amendment 13, and ask the agency to, well, in Amendment 16, to reiterate that and to make sure that the regulations come out in a way that reflects that intent. We then looked at the issue of the recreational and commercial allocations, and the advisory panel wants to be sure that if an allocation is given to the recreational sector, that adequate accountability measures will be enacted to make sure to control the catch of the recreational sector within that allocation. And the panel recommended that to simplify administration, that one-time period, that is 1996 to 2006, should be used for both the commercial and recreational allocation of groundfish. Then we moved on to the issue of sector monitoring and noted that the draft Amendment 16 calls for some level of dockside monitoring as well as at sea monitoring, but does not specify a specific level. And the GAP recommends that the council does not specify specific levels of coverage in the amendment, but instead each sector would have to justify with the National Marine Fisheries Service that they had an adequate level of coverage that would meet a certain level of precision. One panel member, was concerned about the fact that when a permit holder signs up for a sector, he's restricted to that sector for the entire fishing year, and wanted to see if that could be modified, but ultimately the GAP could not support that kind of recommendation. We then looked at the issue of vessels in the confirmation of permit history category not being able to be in a sector or to lease days at sea. And again, in your correspondence, you have a letter from Terry Alexander, which is also document number three. Actually, they're all number three, but in which he explains, in which he questions why a permit must be attached to a vessel in order to lease days at sea or to participate in a sector. And the advisory panel recommends that the councils allow permits in the CPH category to lease days at sea or to join sectors, and this would eliminate the common practice now of putting permits on skiffs and other kinds of platforms in order to participate in the days at sea leasing program, and then people have to report, submit, did not fish logbooks every month and register these skiffs every year and complete a lot of unnecessary paperwork. And then the GAP also recommended that the council consider tasking an ad hoc committee to take a more comprehensive look at all the vessel replacement and upgrade requirements. We noted that in the Days at Sea Transfer Program, the council eliminated the need to match up tonnage. In that same kind of situation is being considered now by the Scallop Committee for stacking of permits in the scallop fishery. And rather than doing that, those kind of things on a piecemeal basis, the advisors felt that the council should look at those requirements and see if things like tonnage matching is still appropriate. One of the panel members raised the issue of the inability of the gillnet fleet to effectively catch haddock with the mesh size that is required. And given the current status of both Gulf of Maine cod and Gulf of Maine haddock, the GAP recommends that the council initiate a kind of a pilot program that would allow the use of a limited number, 30 six-inch gillnets during a specific time period, January through April, for the purpose of targeting Gulf of Maine haddock. And the GAP would support you know, layering on that a number of requirements to have a letter of authorization, advance notice, special reporting requirements, et cetera. When Amendment 13 was implemented, the carryover days were assigned to the Category B days at sea allocation, and the GAAP members were concerned that something like that may happen again in Amendment 16, and they would strongly urge the council not to to do that, and if they did so, that should be telegraphed way in advance so that people can make plans to use those days at sea. There was a lot of concern expressed about the current trip limits causing excessive discards, and staff explained that the committee is developing an option that would eliminate all trip limits and use days at sea cuts in order to achieve the reductions required, but in the past that kind of approach has not been acceptable to the industry. The next two issues are two that, as I said at the beginning, I probably didn't pay as much attention to as I should have. The advisors reviewed a letter from an industry member, which is not in your materials, regarding the problems that are being caused by dogfish in the groundfish fishery. The huge number of dogfish are clogging gill nets, trawl nets, longline gear, and there's also a concern that of the dogfish predation on groundfish. And so the GAAP is urging the council, as I understand it, to take a more active role in the development of the next dogfish action to try to establish a different, a more, what the advisors felt would be a more appropriate biomass target for this fishery, which would be, of course, to allow them to kill more dogfish. And this particular recommendation was dissented by one of the advisory panel members. Then we looked at a one-page outline of a document called the New England Fisheries Revitalization and Economic Development Program, which essentially called for a $150 million appropriation from Congress to support a groundfish buyout and to pay for catch monitoring and sector development. And while the advisory panel would support that kind of appropriation and money coming to the industry, it wasn't clear how that fit into this process, since the council can't ask for money and we couldn't ask the council to ask for money. And there really wasn't any time for the staff to work on helping with this issue, given all the other issues they have to deal with. And again, this last recommendation, I probably would have to ask for the chairman if he remembers or the staff, but I'm not really sure what this recommendation means, unfortunately. But I'll read it. The GAAP recommends that the council clarify its vision of where it is headed so that stakeholders can develop and pursue a parallel process to assist in transitions as necessary to achieve those goals. So that's what I have on the report. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have that I might be able to answer.
Any questions for Maggie? Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, Maggie, on the joint and several liability, the recommendation is that we revert to the Amendment 13 language. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. I've been very concerned about this. I mean, I'm concerned about joint and several liability no matter which language you use. I don't want to be liable for somebody else, but at the very least, I think we ought to have some discussion of that today. That was first. And the second one was on consolidation. Again, I brought this up several times. We have the proposal for kind of a tax-free holiday here in Amendment 16. But the fact is that most people are not going to be able to consolidate, not because of groundfish issues, but because most boats have maybe a dozen different permits, and they all have different baselines. You know, fluke is different from herring, is different from groundfish, is different from whatever, scallops, whatever. And so is the recommendation to kind of develop an omnibus consolidation bill where we find a way to make it possible to consolidate all these permits with different baselines?
Yes, I believe that would be a fair way to characterize it. Several years ago, there was a kind of a omnibus amendment that made the same vessel replacement and upgrade restrictions for all of the permits. So you're correct. What happens then if you try to stack permits that even, for example, have a different tonnage that aren't within the upgrade restrictions? You can do that, but you lose. You have to give up that other limited access permit if it has a different baseline.
That's right. You the way it's worded right now, you get the worst combination of permits possible. It seems counterintuitive. It would seem that we would want to get the best combination of permits possible, since a number of permits go away permanently every time you consolidate. You know, let's say you consolidate three permits, they all have a dozen permits. That's 36 permits. You're going to end up with a dozen. That means 24 go away permanently, forever. They're not here to clog the system, put boats back into it when fisheries change. I'm not sure what the proper way to move forward is, but I don't want to see the Amendment 16 tax-free holiday move forward and then not have anybody be able to use it, because all the other plans have restrictions that keep them from consolidating those permits. Because nobody will consolidate if they have to give up a good permit. I mean, if it's an open access permit, who cares? But if it's a limited access permit and it has a different baseline and a different fishery, nobody will consolidate if they have to give up that permit. At least I can't imagine anybody would. So I guess I'd ask the chair what the best way to go forward would be. Would it be to have an omnibus bill considered for priorities in November, or how do we deal with this?
Yeah, it's on a short list of things I'll be meeting with the executive director about over the next couple of weeks, that issue and revisiting what's called the consistency amendment, which had to do with permit splitting as well. So hopefully in November, at the next executive committee meeting, we'll have a discussion about it. And then in November, during priorities, I'll make sure we set apart enough time to talk about these issues as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Jim Otham.
Yeah, in your deliberations, I just want to point out that we had a capacity committee and nothing happened. I mean, 3 or 4 years ago, we had a capacity committee to deal with just these issues, and all we got was, I can't remember what it was, sector policy out of it. But the original reason we set up that committee was to deal with capacity issues.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maggie, I think that there were, in our discussions prior to the meeting, several of these items that it was the desire of the GAP to have discussed today. I had down the confirmation of permit history, the days at sea cap, and the liability issue as the three major issues that you felt it would be beneficial to have some council discussion today and maybe get some sort of resolution on those. There are a number of other items that are essentially recommendations that should come through the committee and then back eventually to the council for consideration. So I'm thinking that we need to focus in on those three issues and perhaps take them one by one, have some discussion, and the council can either, you know, dispose of them or make recommendations of how it should be handled back to or back through the committee, whatever the council's pleasure is. So why don't we start with the confirmation of permit history question.
Well, again, this, you know, if you look at the letter in your folder from Terry Alexander to the committee, he talks about the fact that one of the vessels in the sustainable harvest sector recently sank, and that permit now can't be in the sector unless it's attached to some vessel, and some explanation was given to the surviving owner of that permit about what he needed to do, and he just couldn't believe that he needed to put this permit on a skiff in order to continue to participate in the sector. So we're trying to figure out what is the rationale for making these permits be attached to a vessel. Again, if you look back at Amendment 13, the rationale simply says this provision slows the reactivation of effort that is frozen in the permit history category. Well, there's nothing frozen. All you have to do is take the permit out and attach it to a vessel. The advisory panel is just wondering what is the comments, you know, what is the purpose of requiring that when the vessel, when the permit could be sitting in a drawer and still be used either for days at sea leasing or to participate in the sector?
Jim Adler.
Yeah, I think to move the discussion along on this issue, I'll make a motion that permits in CPH be allowed to lease groundfish days at sea and participate in groundfish sectors.
Is there a second? Seconded by Mary Beth. Any further discussion or rationale, Jim or Mary Beth? Anyone else in the council? David?
Yeah. How much of an increase in mortality will this produce?
Sorry, Dave, I was in the sidebar.
How much of an increase in mortality will this produce? I mean, I think that's the question we have to answer before we can vote on this. It's clearly going to increase mortality.
Mary Beth?
I don't think it's going to increase mortality because everybody knows how you get around it today. You put the permit on a canoe, you register your canoe, and you send in your paperwork every month. So it just rationalizes a system that's not worth doing.
David?
If that was the case, why do we have permits in CPH? Obviously we do, so obviously there are people who are not doing that. This is about sectors and activating fishing power without actually building a fishing boat or building even a canoe. It may seem like a relatively insignificant discussion, but it's about mortality, and therefore it is significant. And so we need the answer. We need the staff to analyze how much increase in mortality this will produce before we can vote on this.
Tom Neese.
I can't specifically answer David's question now. But I just want to point out to the council that you had this discussion in January, almost this identical discussion. A suggestion was made in January that talk about whether CPH permits should be allowed to participate, specifically in sectors at the time, because that was our January meeting. And the council made it clear in January that they wanted to keep permits in CPH ineligible from being in sectors. Now, looking through my notes, I'm not sure the rationale that the council advanced in January is any more detailed than the rationale they explained that Maggie pointed out is pretty weak in Amendment 13. But we've had this discussion at least once before within the last year at some length.
Pat Kirkle.
Yeah, there are permits in CPH. There are 91 permits right now in CPH, so it is a potential increase in effort, and that's clearly something the council would need to take into consideration. I'm not arguing necessarily for or against it, but regardless of which way you go, you have to take into account the potential for the increase in effort.
Maggie?
Well, and this is not a final decision, obviously. That analysis would have to be done if the council approves this motion, and then you would make a final decision on whether or not you thought there was an increase in effort and whether or not that would be harmful at a later time. So I would just urge you to advance this and see where it ends up in the final vote.
Anyone else on the council? Dr. Pierce.
Well, somewhat relative to this motion and others that may be made, I'd like a little bit of guidance, Mr. Chairman, as to how you intend to have us proceed this morning on groundfish. Are we acting as a committee of the whole, and are we going to then have to respond to, make motions that would relate to all of the two reports that we have from the Recreational Advisory Panel and the other panel? Just a little guidance as to what we're doing here, because it has implications regarding the amount of thought we have to give into all of these individual issues. I thought this was going to go back to the groundfish committee. Reports provided back to the groundfish committee for some thoughtful discussion, input from Tom Neese, the plan development team, as opposed to our picking and choosing and then giving it to the plan development team for further work, and then we address it once again at the groundfish committee. Was it a wise decision or not? So please give us some guidance as to how you would like us to proceed, since certainly the only groundfish action that's scheduled here for today is this approval of the TACs for the Eastern Georges Bank Cod and Haddock and the Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder, and we did that yesterday. So where are we going with all of this?
As Rick pointed out, the groundfish committee meeting was canceled as a result of nothing to do, I guess. My preference would be, unless there's strong objection, to behave as a committee of the whole today and to try to work through some of these issues. If there's disagreement amongst the council, you'll either vote down all motions or object to motions being put up. I'm willing to entertain that conversation as well, but we have a limited amount of time. We have a laundry list of issues that we continually put off till the next meeting, and I think we do need to make some decisions right now. That would be my guidance or my preference, Dr. Pierce. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on that, David, the fact that we didn't have the meeting is the reason that the RAP and the GAP have come here today to the council to report rather than coming to the committee, because the meeting was canceled. And hopefully these would have been issues that would have been dealt with by the committee, but there was a request through the GAP that these three items get dealt with today. It's something that, at least in, particularly on the liability issue, there's a great deal of concern in the formation of sectors, and it's stalling off people actually signing into the sectors because they're concerned with that. So that's why we wanted to deal with these three issues today. It's not the intent is not to open up everything for discussion. The decisions of the council would be taken back to the committee and worked on and integrated into Amendment 16.
Anyone else on the council?
Rodney.
Yeah, thank you. This is a question for you, either Pat or Doug. Those history category permits, the 90-some-odd you were talking about, do they have A and B days? My understanding was most of those had C days, and they were just trying to hold them. They have A and B days?
They have both.
Dave Gatham.
Yes, I'd call the council's attention to under correspondence number 8. There's a letter 8A, and that's a response from the council to Mr. Terry Alexander that outlines our current policy and the votes that were taken and the rationale for the votes. I think it's quite clear. It pretty well is a good synopsis of this issue in a nutshell.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Anything further? Back to the audience. Rich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question, and I think it should be looked at. The 91 permits in that CPH, how many of those permits leased their days and then put it into the CPH? I think that's the question you should look at. Because if that's the case, it's not going to make a difference because those days are leased already and then they put it into the CPH. So you see how many permits are in there that lease days already.
Vito?
Vito Gelloni, North DC Food Coalition. I think it's definitely worth looking into. The CPH permits, right, there's nothing precluding them from being activated right now. I mean, they can just put it on a skiff and lease the days. So if there's some mortality value to those, there's nothing stopping those permits from all 91 being on a skiff tomorrow. So this is an administrative issue, and I think that might be worth just asking the PDT to take a quick look or NIMS to take a quick look to see how many of those 91 permits, as Richie said, actually leased their days anyway, and then shift them from one vessel to another and put them into CPH. CPH is sort of a parking place for a permit that's going to go somewhere. So those days are basically eligible now. Take a day to put those permits back on. What we'd really like to see is a look to get out of a lot of the crazy things of putting permits on skiffs and registering them and log books and all the things that go along with that game and have all of the permits that are now being used that way in the fishery go into something that makes a lot more sense, which would be a CPH type thing. And I think the look at the mortality is worth doing, but I don't think there's anything precluding those days from being used right now.
Back to the council. Jim Allen.
Just one comment. When you're looking at it, you also have to look at the makeup, how many A days are in CPH, and the makeup of those A days. They're probably, if they're not being leased to somebody now, they're what I would call abnormal days. In other words, they can't fit anything. They're probably something that used to be on a skiff or, you know, has very limited number of days, but it has a 100-horse engine with a 40-foot boat. They're what we call, they can't be leased because they're abnormal. Nobody, they wouldn't fit anything. So even if you did the allowed CPH leasing, those days may not be leasable because they just don't fit anything. And so I think you have to look at that when you look at when you take your look, and also look at how many A days in total there are in CPH. Thank you.
Anyone else in the council? You ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Eleven opposed.
Four.
Four opposed. Abstentions. Two. 11-4-2. The motion carries.
Item number two on the list was the days at sea leasing cap. It was brought to my attention this morning by staff that in April of this year we did again have a council vote on that to remove the days at sea leasing cap, and at that point in time it was rejected by the council.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could somebody remind me, not having a lot of detail on some groundfish issues, what the cap currently is.
Who wants to answer that question? What the current cap is on leasing? Maggie does. Maggie.
Just looking to see if it was... okay. Current regulations limit vessels to leasing the amount up to that vessel's 2001 fishing year allocation. For example, if a vessel was allocated 88 days at sea in the 2001 fishing year, the vessel may lease up to 88 days at sea. So if you, the average vessel now, I believe, has 43 or 48 days at sea. If you add that to the 88, the total number of days that that vessel can have through leasing is 136. So in the, for vessels that, the reason why this is a big issue now is because for the vessels that participate, that are in the two-for-one counting area, that really means that they only have 68 days that they can fish because of that cap. So again, there's no cap on the number of days that can be accumulated through a days at sea transfer if you can purchase those and stack permits. If you have the resources to do that, you can stack as many days at sea as you want on a vessel. You can also increase your days at sea leasing baseline by doing that. If you put two permits on a vessel, then you get double the baseline. And then you can stack double the, you can lease double the amount of days at sea. So really all it, all this cap does, because it can be circumvented in other ways, is to penalize people who can't afford to stack permits.
Jim Otham?
Yeah, there's one other additional thing that's going on is that people are taking sea permits, which can't be used for anything in groundfish, and they're increasing their leasing baseline by just absorbing the sea permits, which they can buy very cheap. So you really don't have anything here. You know, it's just smoke, you know.
Tom Neese.
I was just going to explain the rule, which Maggie has already explained what it was.
Anyone else on the council? Rip?
I guess if we're going to take some action, we need a motion. If we don't have the motion, we'll move on to the next item. Mike? Oh.
It's a question. So is this a motion to reconsider the motion that we took in April and probably?
There's no motion.
What's that?
There's no motion.
Is it ruled out of order if we put the same motion up that was defeated in April in Providence?
No.
No? I'd like to make a motion to remove the days at sea leasing cap.
There's a second. Seconded by Mary Beth. Discussion? Dave Gable.
Say the same thing about the one I just lost. This is an increase in mortality. Don't anybody kid yourself one way or the other. It's not all smoke. You got to find a permit that matches your boat. You got to buy it. You got to put it on a skiff. You got to spend, you know, some money here to do this. Most people don't want to do it. This is a way for people to get for free what they currently got to pay for. It's an increase in mortality, just like the last one was. And, you know, on the one hand, we sit here and we constantly try to cut mortality, and then we turn around and we say, well, that's nice, let's increase it again. You know, we look like a bunch of yo-yos here. We're up, we're down, we're up, we're down, we're up, we're down. You know, and it's, I don't know. I just rest my case.
Dr. Pierce.
I share David's frustration in that if this passes, then we will change our mind on two issues that we debated at length at previous meetings. without having reflected on, let's say, the minutes of those particular meetings and all the discussion that we had that led us to conclude that, you know, we shouldn't remove the days at sea leasing cap. It's a bad way to do business, and I don't pretend to remember all the discussions we had on this issue or any other issue for that matter 6 months ago. If this passes, then it's kind of, well, not kind of, it is embarrassing.
Anyone else on the council? Audience? Oh, sorry, Dave Simpson before I go to the audience.
No, I guess I'll just say generally, as a confession, I was not prepared to deal with any of this or understand the implications of any of this, so I feel very uncomfortable doing this. And maybe that's my fault, but that's where I am with it. I have no idea what the implication of this is. I haven't had a chance to think about it.
Go to the audience. Vito and then Richie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, at the risk appearing to be going against what the council did in the past, I think this is such a critical issue, it's worth at least bringing up again why the industry is so concerned about it. From a break-even analysis standpoint, I haven't seen or really looked, and that's my fault for not looking at the EIS closer to see if we have the types of break-even analysis from a NEPA standpoint for this action as we have in the past. I remember Amendment 13, there was a certain amount of days that a full-time groundfish operation that didn't have other permits needed to survive. And I don't know if that's just hidden in the document now or be transferability came up, and I think we had less concern about whether someone could break even with their own allocation because you were able to go out and seek additional days. This is a supply and demand issue now. Since the 2-to-1 counting, we had made the argument that you were basically capped at 68 days, like Maggie just said. But what happens when you have a day at sea cut, you have a decrease in your allocation, which means the need is increased proportionate to the decrease in days at sea, while at the same time the supply, everyone's, all the people that are leasing days out, the supply goes down by the same amount. So you got a double-edged sword there, cutting the industry, making the ability to find the days even more difficult. That's a mathematical reality. You have a limited access here. You can't create new days or cut new stock. So if there's any tweak in differential counting and further days at sea cuts, it is going to be a mathematical reality that people aren't going to find. The other thing on the sea day permits, I'll go against the smoke part of it right now. That was pretty easy to find for the first folks that figured out that loophole and grabbed a sea day permit for cheap money. Now most of the sea day permits have valuable squid or some other monkfish permit on it that's too valuable to sell for cheap money. So those folks are hanging on to those permits, and the sea day permits are not readily available now to increase your baseline. So we right now I think we may be depending upon some mitigating programs that don't really have the supply that we think it has. You're not going to easily find a sea day permit. You're not going to easily find days at sea. We're going to have a day at sea cut, guaranteed, even at the default. So your supply goes down while your need goes up. Removing the cap just gives people an opportunity to have a break-even possibility in the market that's going to exist post-Amendment 16, post-interim rule. So we would support serious consideration of this, or at least asking the PDT to do another break-even analysis and actually analyze the market and see what's really available when we talk about someone can just go grab a sea day permit or someone can just go lease days, because those days are drying up fast. Thanks. Dr. Pearson.
I truly appreciate the need, the desire for fishermen, inshore fishermen, for example, in the Gulf of Maine to get more days at sea, to find a source, break even, economic plight. I understand that entirely. However, I have to reflect on what we're going to find out from Tom Neese eventually when we get to his presentation, that if I read this correctly, in light of the work that he has done, perhaps with other plan development team members, revised estimates of what 2007 catch, 2008 catch was, which is expected to be for the Gulf of Maine codfish. And I see that we're looking at the need to cut by about 21%. That's the percent change in F necessary to achieve the F rebuild using catch and F at 2008, so 21%. It's not as I thought it would be. The numbers are different from what I had seen and we had seen at our last meeting, and Tom made it very clear to us that after further reflection, the assumed catch in 2008 might go up for some of these stocks. And that's what has happened for Gulf of Maine codfish. So with a 21% reduction in F, that, of course, the regional administrator is going to have to address through interim action, and then we, of course, will have to address through our amendment, I just find it difficult to justify this sort of a strategy that, without analyses, will, I suspect, likely make it harder for us to achieve that percent cut in fishing mortality.
Dave Gaith.
Yeah, let me try a little bit different approach here. Nobody has suffered more under Framework 42 than the people in New Hampshire. We live in the center of the differential counting zone. We can't get outside it. That's the only place we fish. We've taken enormous cuts. We had 20 boats in my harbor, Amendment 13. Now we got 7. Every time we give something back, we've got to take something else away. You have to balance the books. So if Tom is going to say we need a 21% cut, and then we put back in 90 CPH permits and a whole bunch of CDA permits, increase the leasing cap, he's going to have to go rework those numbers. Maybe he's going to come back and say you're going to give 25% now. I don't know what it's going to be. Nobody knows what it's going to be. But you have to balance the books. And people, you know, I would stand to benefit more from this. People in my harbor would stand to benefit more from these last two actions than anybody. It'll be more stuff to go out there and grab. But when they go out there and grab it, it's going to be an increase in mortality because they're going to fish it. And when they fish it, they're going to kill something. And we're trying to keep people from killing stuff. The fact is we got 550 permits that bought a VMS. We clearly can't support the 550 we have because we already got to take another 25% cut. 21, whatever it is. You've got 1,450 permits out there. 900 people are never going to fish again one way or the other. And every time we sit here and tell them that they might get a chance to, that's smoke and mirrors. Because we can't support 550 boats. So why do we keep doing this stuff? Why do we keep putting this stuff out there and then just having to turn around and cut it some more? Nobody wants to face the fact that you're not going to get the fish for groundfish for much in the next 10 years. If your business plan relies on 100% groundfish, you're probably already out of business. You just haven't figured it out yet. I don't care how many permits you buy. Because you're not going to get to fish much. And to sit here and keep doing this over and over and over, to me, as a ground fisherman, I used to fish 230 days groundfish in a year. I can't do that anymore. I can't fish anywhere near that much. And the people in my harbor used to do the same thing. I just use myself as an example because people get kind of ticked if I use other people as examples. But we have got to find a way to get mortality on groundfish under control. And the way is not to take the 20% of the people that catch 80% of the fish and keep giving them a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's never going to happen that way. Never, ever, ever. So, you know, we vote this up, we vote it down, whatever. I as a ground fisherman, as somebody who used to make his entire living ground fishing and now hardly ever goes ground fishing and spends most of his time fishing for things that are worth virtually nothing, breaking his back, I am fed up with the process, I'm fed up with the council, and I'm fed up with my fellow fishermen. Because they don't want to confront the problem. So, thank you.
I think we've had enough debate on this. We've debated it before. So, everybody ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. 4, 5. Opposed? Eleven. Abstentions? Motion fails. Was it 4 or 5 to 11? 5 to 11. Rep, please take up the next item from the GAP.
The next item is the liability question.
Paul Howard.
I just wanted to mention that the Enforcement Committee is meeting the November 17th, the day before the council meeting, to address this. So if the council intends to address it, we'll cancel that meeting.
Jim Oblin.
Yeah, I don't see this as an enforcement issue myself, but I think it's a liability issue for the sector. I mean, but I'm just making a statement, Paul, that I don't believe it's an enforcement issue, so just leave it at that.
Tom Neese.
Yeah, just to review the issue a little bit. Maggie gave the outlines of what's written in Amendment 13 and what's written in the regulations and how that's causing some concern among people who are trying to organize sectors. The recommendation was first brought forward from the Ground Fish Advisory Panel in May. They brought it to the Ground Fish Committee, I think, which met around the 1st or 2nd of June, right before the June Council meeting. And included in that recommendation that the committee then forwarded onto the Council was a suggestion that I don't have the exact council motion wording in front of me, but the motion suggested that there were really only three or four things that should be subject to joint and several liability. When it came up at the council meeting, there was some concern raised about whether those were the right three or four things that should be subject to liability, and the suggestion was made to seek advice from the Enforcement Committee, because that includes no attorneys and no enforcement personnel, about whether that was the right list of offenses that should be subject to joint and several liability. So that's why it got forwarded on to the Enforcement Committee. It kind of fell through the cracks over the course of the summer, and that's why we've scheduled an Enforcement Committee meeting for November to try and get that feedback.
Rep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that update from staff, my suggestion would be that we continue in the direction that the council had already set, that the Enforcement Committee would look at those individual items and come back with a recommendation, and perhaps we can we won't be able to address it at the 30th committee meeting, but we certainly could do it at the committee meeting following that. Yeah, just getting a little late.
Well, we can just talking with Paul, I guess that's the only item the Enforcement Committee is going to meet to talk about, quite frankly. We don't have a lot of action scheduled for today, right? We have a whole day set aside for groundfish. And this is a policy decision and probably a negotiation between the council defining its intent, and there's probably going to have to be some back and forth between NOAA General Counsel and the council over what the bare bones minimum requirements are going to be on this issue. So I would suggest that we table this issue right now. We've got a presentation from Tom and some other items to talk about. And people think about this issue, and we'll come back to it later today. That would be my recommendation. I think the council should give some thought to this and, if possible, act on it today. Either decide to leave it alone, maybe you decide to go down the road that we chose before, which is an Enforcement Committee meeting to talk about it, and then a committee meeting, and then back to the council. But I know there are a lot of concerns amongst potential sector participants that the current interpretation of the current regulation is much too onerous for them, and they're getting advice from their attorneys not to sign into sectors. I've heard that from many people. So let's come back to it later today if possible. I'm not sure we're going to fix the problem today, but we certainly have some time today to think about this. Gene?
Just so I'm clear on what the issue is, I mean, I thought Maggie was saying, maybe she was saying the opposite. I misunderstood. I thought she was questioning whether they should keep the current regulations, which is highlighted in the handout, versus the write-up, the current write-up of this issue in the draft amendment. Is that the issue, or is it something else? And then I'm not sure what the four activities are that are subject to that was just mentioned by Tom, the four types of activities that we're talking about. I mean, I'm not sure what to think about to go back to.
We could give you a lot of things to think about, Gene, but
I have plenty to think about.
You see this handout, right?
Yeah.
The top paragraph was the language from Amendment 13 that set this whole thing in motion. And apparently in the bottom paragraph is the regs, the current regs.
Right. So what was the AP, the advisory group suggesting, that they keep the Amendment 13 regs versus the current?
I'll go to Tom and Maggie.
There's actually been two advisory panel recommendations which are slightly different. Back in May, what the advisory panel suggested and what the committee brought forth to the council was that sectors will be jointly liable only for the following violations of sector policy: ace overages, discarding of legal fish, and misreporting of catch, landings, or discards. That was the motion that was tabled. I think at the more recent advisory panel meeting, the advisory panel took a little bit broader view, and what they've said is, you know, the regulations should reflect the language that's in Amendment 13, which is a little broader. It doesn't specifically identify violations. It says sectors are jointly liable for, and you have the language in front of you, sector policy things. Whereas the current regs say you're jointly liable for any violation of any regulation, I think is how it's worded.
I could just speak a little bit to this because I've been involved in this process since 2004. I think one of the concerns is that a sector may choose to put rules into its plan, into the contract side of the plan that are between the contracting parties, and there may be violations that are non-fishery related. There may be contractual obligations that are agreed to between those parties, and there's a concern that the government may come in and get involved in that, in those issues. They may not, you know, you can't go fishing in a blue boat on a Tuesday, and a guy goes fishing in a blue boat on a Tuesday, and, well, that's a sector deal. That's between the sector parties and the agreement they have. There's a concern that the government may get involved and prosecute that as well because it's in the contract. Go ahead, Gene.
Yeah, just point that out. I mean, that was theoretically covered in the regs and the sentence in the bottom section right before the highlighted section, that it shall be unlawful to violate any such conditions unless such conditions or restrictions are identified as administrative only, so that the sector itself can define which conditions they consider are administrative only versus those that are fishing related. But I mean, I don't want to engage in the debate now for deciding to delay this. I just wanted to try to crystallize what issues we're going to be perhaps talking about when we come back. If it's, I don't know if there's enough specificity really to know exactly what we're going to be debating at the council level, but so be it.
I think the comfort level, for those that are concerned, I think there would be more comfort in having a clear list of items that are defined as those items that do bind the members jointly and severally. And everything else does not apply in that regard. And maybe I'm mischaracterizing the concern. Jim Odlin.
I think it's quite simple. It's that the sectors are willing to be joint and severally liable for things they can control. For instance, you can't control if a guy violates a closed area. The sector can't do that. We don't know if they do it. Don't have the data. But if they do it, that's just a for instance, but why should the sector be liable for that? That's an individual action that the individual took outside the sector that the rest of the sector shouldn't be joint and liable for. If a fisherman goes out with an expired fishing permit, it's not, you know, the sectors are there to monitor catch, make sure people live within their catch limits, and that's the things that they could be and should be joint and severally liable for. The other things that are beyond their control, it's just not right to make a whole group of people liable for something somebody else can do that they can't control. And it's beyond just lawyers saying this. Banks are saying that they may not allow you to go in a sector if you have a broad joint and several liability because it affects their collateral. And I suspect with what's going on, they're going to look at this kind of stuff a lot closer.
All right. So I just would suggest that we've had a bit of a discussion on this, and we can revisit it later today. Maggie?
Thank you. I just want to, on behalf of the advisory panel, thank the council for their consideration of the items that we brought forward. And I do want to say that I do appreciate the concern that have been expressed by Dave Simpson and Dr. Pierce about not understanding the implications of some of these issues, but just point out that these are issues of great importance to the industry, otherwise we would not have brought them forward, and that we're not making a final decision today, and that they, you know, that the analysis will bear out in the end what kind of decision should be made. So we do appreciate the issues that the issue of the CPH that you did deal with. It's unfortunate that the leasing, you couldn't have had some analysis before you made a decision about the leasing cap, but that's what the intent was of our asking for this today. So, again, thank you for your consideration, and we look forward to continuing the discussion on the joint liability because that probably is the most significant issue that we need to deal with. Thank you.
And we're going to take a checkout break, but I just want to point out, when we come back, I'd like to, or at some point today, I'd like to address within the advisory panel report, page 6, the top paragraph. There's a discussion embedded in there that I think the council needs to have. So, but we'll take a 15-minute checkout break. We are back on Groundfish. I believe Tom has a short presentation. Whenever you're ready, Tom.
Thank you. Just going to bring the council a little bit up to speed on what the Amendment 16 schedule looks like and what some of the PDT work that has been accomplished looks like. If you want to take a moment to find item number 3, which is the Groundfish Plan Development Team Report, and then turn back to roughly the most important page is the last page, but roughly page 5 or 6. I'll talk about this report in brief, but I'm not planning to go through all the particular details of it. We've got a little adjustment in the schedule for Amendment 16 development. As we all knew quite some time ago, we knew that once NIMS had to work on their interim action, that the PDT work would stop for a while. NIMS has been working on the interim action during the month of September, and so the PDT work really didn't stop, but it did slow down quite a bit, which is why we wound up canceling the Groundfish Committee meeting that was scheduled for September. So what that means is that we did not have effort controls to bring into the council at this meeting for approval. So basically what we hope to happen is to come into the council in November. And that would pretty much be the last chance for the council to approve measures that would be developed into the draft environmental impact statement. This is not going to be an easy thing to do. We have a Groundfish Committee meeting scheduled at the end of the month, and I'm hoping that the PDT resumes work next week in order to get ready for that committee meeting. If we don't approve the measures in November, then I think we may have to think of some creative ways to get this keep this on track. If we do approve the measures in November, then ideally we would bring the DEIS to the council at the February council meeting for approval, which would then allow us to take it out to public hearing I'm saying April, May. Ideally, we'd like to get the public hearings going in May. There is always a little bit of a lag between the council approval of the DEIS and submission of the document to NIMS, NIMS acceptance of the document, publication of the notice of availability, and that type of stuff. So, you know, late April, early May is a rough timeline for public hearings. That would allow the council to make the final decisions on the action, in June of 2009. We would then submit the document that summer, and NIMS would plan on implementing the document May 1st of 2010. Now, there's actually a lot of things that happened between June 2009 and May 2010 that I haven't put on here, primarily because most of those are internal to the agency and how they review and publish the documents. What remains to be done, first, we need to develop new rebuilding plan options. Now, what I mean by that, to be more specific, is for the stocks that are newly overfished, the council gave us some guidance in September on bringing forward some alternatives for rebuilding plans. That work has not been completed yet. We should be able to get that work done in relatively short order and bring that back in November. The other thing, and this is probably the biggest thing, is that we need to develop the measures to achieve rebuilding. These are both the commercial and recreational management measures that will achieve the mortality targets under either the old rebuilding plans or for the newly overfished stocks, the new rebuilding plans. Now, I would like to mention that designing these measures, particularly for the commercial fishery, is going to be somewhat difficult. We are still, of course, planning on implementing sectors, perhaps in a large way, in Amendment 16. The measures are likely going to have to be somewhat broad brush because we don't really know who is going to be in a sector and who is not going to be in a sector at this point. We still have some work to do on annual catch limits. Much of what we hope to put in the amendment document is already in the amendment document. But we've had some conversations with the SSC, and the PDT is on the hook for providing some sort of a guidance document or a technical document that talks about how we're going to bring forward recommendations for ABC to the SSC and how we're going to turn those into recommendations for annual catch limits. We've done some preliminary work with the SSC and got their, I don't want to call it their blessing, but their recognition that they seem to think we're headed in the right direction on that. But we have to work out some of those details. I don't know if all that's going to be done by February. I'm not convinced it all needs to be done by February because our plan is that that would be something of a standalone document and wouldn't be embedded in the amendment. Similarly, we have some accountability measure details to work out for both the recreational and the commercial fisheries. There was some draft work that we put together for the committee earlier this summer, but I think we need to refine it a little bit. And we really haven't done too much on the accountability measure details for the recreational fishery either. As was mentioned earlier, I think, with the advisory panel report from Maggie Raymond, there's still some work on sector monitoring. We talked about this at our last council meeting, so I won't go into any detail other than note that Ann Hawkins on our staff is still working with the regional office to try and put together some text that explains and describes sector monitoring requirements in a broad brush way with enough detail that we know what we really are getting out of it. So in specific generalities, I guess, is how we're trying to write that up. And then finally, there's some question about Atlantic wolffish. I think the other day you received a report that there was, and I'm not sure I've got the terms right, a request for listing. I think that is perhaps how it's worded, that was filed for Atlantic wolffish. And, you know, I'd like to highlight that there are some misrepresentations in that report, for example, where it says that the council has refused to incorporate Atlantic wolffish into Amendment 16. The reality is that this is an issue that we identified quite some time ago as a possibility that we would try and incorporate Atlantic wolffish into the management unit. And one of the problems we have had with that is that the advice that in general we've been getting is that if we want to incorporate wolffish into a management unit, then we have to be able to define the status determination criteria and designate essential fish habitat and a lot of that other stuff. And we don't have an assessment for Atlantic wolffish at present. And so we've been talking, and the NRCC has been trying to schedule a data poor working group meeting, which is now ongoing. It started a couple weeks ago and is planned to be finished in December. And wolffish is one of the species that's before the data poor working group, and hopefully that they will be able to come up with status determination criteria for that stock. So at that point, I think the council will have to make a decision whether to incorporate wolffish into the management unit for groundfish. There are, you know, we're in a little bit of a bind, I think, perhaps with the Magnuson-Stevens Act and wolffish, in that, as I said, some of the advice we've been getting is that if we want to incorporate measures that are designed to specifically address wolffish and reduce mortality on wolffish, then it needs to be incorporated into the management unit. We need to have status determination criteria. And we may not have that stuff. We don't have it now, for example. We may or may not get it. We hope to get it out of the data poor working group meeting, but we may not. And so that hamstrings us a little bit on having measures in the amendment that are specifically designed for wolffish. So, you know, that's a question that I don't think we're going to be able to answer until later when we know the results of that particular meeting. And then, of course, it's not easy to prepare the DEIS. We have been working on this with some of the background material. For anyone who's interested, we have been periodically updating on our website what the draft DEIS is at the moment. It's not complete, but it does allow people to see how the development is ongoing and to take a look at it. It's on our, if you want to find it, it's a hidden a little bit. You have to know where to look. It's on our Northeast Multispecies webpage. It's listed, I think, as Amendment 16 Management Measures, but if you click on that link now, the draft DEIS is there as it stood about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Well, maybe not that long, as it stood at the end of September. So that covers the schedule. I'm going to shift gears now and talk a little bit about work that the PDT has completed. And if you want more details, you can look at the PDT report that's in your binder. One of the things we have done is, at least for the stocks that are currently in rebuilding programs or that are not in a rebuilding program, we have tried to estimate the mortality objectives for those stocks. We haven't estimated the mortality objectives for stocks that are in the newly overfished category. We have done some illustrative examples of what it might look like, but these are not recommendations. They were not done entirely consistently with the council's advice in September. They were done before that. So those are going to change, and you shouldn't really look at those as more than an indicator of what might be needed for those particular stocks. There are a few things that have changed in comparison to the GARM projections that you heard in September. I think the largest one is that whereas the GARM, for the most part, assumed that catch in 2008 was the same as catch in 2007, we tried to estimate and predict what we think the catch in 2008 is going to be, and we used that to estimate the mortality for 2008. Now, the PDT report has all the details of how we estimated catch. I will caution that, as mentioned in the PDT report, you know, this method has worked surprisingly well for as simplistic as it is in the past, but it's not perfect. It's based on some discard estimates from the GARM, so if discards this year changed, you could expect that those numbers would change. We don't have current year estimates of what the recreational catch is, so if the recreational catch is vastly different from what it was last year, you know, that could be another change. And it's only based on a limited amount, about half a year, of landings information. So, you know, there's room for errors. And having said all that, our catch estimates in the past have been generally within about 10 or 15% of what the catch actually turns out. We did not change any of what I've called here the biological parameters. Those were all determined by the GARM. There's a whole list of those, but, for example, the partial recruitment pattern, selectivity in the fishery, the weight at age, the growth, the numbers, you know, we didn't change any of those. Those are all the same as what was used in the GARM. The other thing that we did is that we recognized that Amendment 16 is not going to be in a place until 2010, so we had to make some sort of assumption on 2009 fishing mortality. And that's spelled out. We basically had two assumptions. One is that, and these were explained to the council in September, one is that for the stocks in a rebuilding program, we assume that in 2009 the interim action achieves the rebuilding F. For the newly overfished stocks, we assume the interim action ends overfishing, gets mortality down to FMSY. Now, the reality is that what you assume for catch in 2008 doesn't have a whole lot of impact on your rebuilding F. It does, however, have a lot of impact on what the reduction is from where you are now to where you think you need to be in 2010. If you look at the table that's in the PDT report, you'll see that in some instances we think the catch has gone up since 2007. For example, Gulf of Maine cod and Georges Bank cod, we think we'll have more catch in 2008 than in 2007. But there are also examples where, at least based on the 6 months of landings data, it looks like the catch might be lower in 2007 than it was in 2008. The other way around, 2008 than in 2007. So after you do all this and you put it in the projection model, you can figure out what sort of mortality reduction you need to get from what we think the mortality might be in 2008 to the mortality that we need to rebuild if we start in 2010. And these are the reductions. Gulf of Maine. I'm not going to read all the reductions. I'll just make some general comments. Georges Bank, I think the issue is Georges Bank cod, where the catch appears to have gone to be going up in 2008. We think we might need a 55% reduction in Georges cod mortality to achieve the rebuilding target. Some other large ones that you'll notice are listed in italics are which flounder? I left it blank. I apologize for that. There's one in the table in the PDT report. But these in italics are the ones that are the newly overfished stocks, and these exact numbers will depend on what the council chooses for the rebuilding plans for those particular stocks. In the case of northern windowpane, that 74% reduction is to get from the estimated F down to FMSY. We don't really have a projection for that stock. In the case of most of the stocks where it's shown as NA, that means either that they don't need a reduction or that an increase could, in theory, be possible based on our estimate of 2008 mortality. If we move on to southern New England, mid-Atlantic area, yellowtail flounder, about a 38% reduction, and winter flounder is the big question mark here. The stock doesn't appear that it will rebuild by 2014 in the absence of any fishing mortality. And the PDT is a little confused. We don't know what the policy guidance is for how to deal with that particular situation. If you think you actually need to have 100% reduction in fishing mortality, that basically means you would cut down all fishing in the southern New England winter flounder stock area. And that would include all fishing. That would mean any scallop dredge, because the scallop dredges catch somewhere on the orders of 100 tons of winter flounder, which is probably around 5 to 10% of the removals, not very much. The fluke fishery catches some. But the reality is that we're not really sure what the requirement is in this case, where you know the stock won't rebuild by the end of the rebuilding period in the absence of any fishing mortality. So that's pretty much all the PDT has accomplished so far. As I mentioned, we are working on the rebuilding needs for the newly overfished stocks, and we hope to begin work on the effort control measures, and I suspect that we'll get back to that work next week. And that ends my presentation. I'm willing to answer any questions you might have that I can answer.
Any questions for Tom? Dave Simpson.
Yeah, Yeah, just a clarification. I thought the last report the council received that I didn't get directly, but I you know, read the reports, was that winter flounder, southern New England winter flounder, were not expected. We did not believe we could rebuild by 2014, even in the absence of fishing, unless there was a substantial improvement in recruitment.
I think that's accurate.
Okay, misunderstood. I thought in your presentation that if we eliminated fishing, that we could rebuild. That's not what you said?
No. What I meant to say is that even in the absence of any fishing, it won't rebuild by 2014.
Dave Gathel.
Tom, have you gotten the T-Mins that we requested last council meeting so that we could figure out what our rebuilding periods are yet?
Well, the answer is sort of yes and no. We did get the team minimums. In other words, how quickly would the stock be rebuilt with a 75% probability in the absence of any fishing? I don't have them with me. We needed to redo some of the work on the other end, which was, you know, what's the rebuilding F for the 10-year rebuilding program, and we were doing that all at the same time. I will say that I do know that all of the T-Mins for the newly overfished stocks do suggest that they could rebuild in less than 10 years in the absence of fishing. So I think they were all somewhere in the – some of them were – well, I don't remember the exact details, but they were all less than 10 years.
Okay. My second question was on the plan development team report, and I try to – I guess what I'd say is – on the pluses and the minuses, I'm a little bit confused as I follow it through the various tables. If you just follow one species through, the one I'm most familiar with is Gulf of Maine cod. It looks like we start with an actual catch versus the estimated catch of it's less than. As the estimate was 6,400, the actual was 5,200, and then it says 23%. So we were 23% to the good. Is that correct? That's why it's a plus, not a minus.
Can you tell me which table you're looking at?
I'm looking at table one on page two.
This first part of that, let me back up. Before the PDT started estimating catches, it's basically a method we've used for some time. Before we did that, we thought we'd go back and we'd say, okay, we've done this in the past. How well did it perform? And then we actually carried that on, and we said all of these analyses fed into some of the decisions in Framework 42 on what the mortality objectives were, what sort of reductions we needed. And so this first section of the PDT report takes a look at all that stuff and kind of says, how well did it perform for Framework 42 based on what we know now under GARM 3? There's some inconsistencies there. That's why I wanted to make it clear about based on what we know. And what this first table does is the column labeled Framework 42 estimate is the estimate that we used in Framework 42. And it compares it to what the actual catch was in GARM 3. And so, as David pointed out, in Framework 42, we estimated the Gulf of Maine cod catch in 2005 would be 6,400 tons. The actual catch was 5,200 tons. So Framework 42 was, the number we came up with, Framework 42 was positive, was 23% higher. Now, you can argue whether that's good or bad, okay, but from one standpoint, you can say, okay, so the estimate you used when planning measured was high, so you could say that's precautionary. That's how one person might argue it. Somebody else might argue and say the estimate you used for 2005 was high, so your measures were more restrictive than necessary. That's how somebody else might argue.
Right, and what I'm saying is I want to follow it all the way through if we could, you know, to the end, because I think it would be illustrative of where we're trying to go. So let's just say we started with fish in the bank, if you will, irregardless of the arguments of good or bad.
Well, okay.
And then you go to the next table and you kind of get, I'd like you to walk through the tables, basically, and show how you come out at the end with what we got to do.
Okay, I'll give it a try. I think I can do that. But I want to caution you that you know, you have a little bit of, I'm not quite sure how to say this, you've got some problems when we do this that are mentioned in the PDT report, and I'll highlight some of them as an example to start with. And, for example, if the assessment model changed between what it was in GARM 2 and what it is now in GARM 3, that may affect how you interpret these numbers and these calculations over time. And I'm not really sure, you know, how that does things to you. All right, so that's the first table, is the catch table. And then in table 2, what we did is we took, so when we design measures, we start with framework 42. We just start with a catch estimate in what we call the bridge year, 2005. GARM 2 assessments went through 2004. Our measures were going to start in 2006. We try and figure out what's going on in 2005. And what we do is we estimate a catch in 2005, which is what's shown in table 1. We plug that into the projection model that we have. That gives us an estimated fishing mortality in 2005. And then we can compare that to where we thought we were in 2004. And so, you know, that gives us an idea of, you know, what was the change from 2004 to 2005? What did we think it was going to be when we did this catch estimate in the past? And then we go back and we look at the GARM and we say, all right, what does GARM 3 say actually happened from 2004 to 2005? And how did that compare to what we guessed happened from 2004 to 2005? When you make these comparisons, you've got to remember, I think, one important thing that's highlighted in the GARM 3 report is that in GARM 2, remember that 2004 is the terminal year of your assessment. The terminal year estimates are always subject to uncertainty, and in particular, in GARM 2, they were not adjusted for any retrospective patterns. In GARM 3, they are. So presumably, the GARM 3 terminal year estimates should be more accurate than the GARM 2 ones were. But anyways, if you look at Table 2, we show that GARM 3, the actual change in F for Gulf of Maine cod, it increased from 04 to 05 by 18%, whereas the work we did on using the Framework 42 catch estimates was we expected a decline of about 40% from 04 to 05 based on the catch estimate, and we didn't get that. And you can see that I think is probably the largest difference. If I recall, there's one other one in there. Southern New England Yellowtail is another one where it basically stayed flat according to GARM 3, whereas we expected a large reduction from one year to the next. Now, this is where things get a little weird. If you look at Table 3, when we did all this work trying to calculate the mortality objectives for Framework 42, when we did all this work, we looked at it and we said, okay, what do we need to target in the framework action? How much of a reduction do we need to target for the stocks where we're not meeting the mortality targets? And at the time, there were 6 or 7 of them, which are shown in Table 3. And if you look at Framework 42, our ability on the PDT is we really can't dial in and say we're trying to achieve a specific F. What we can do is we can say, we think we know where we are, and we're trying to achieve a reduction from that F to another F. So if you look in the framework action, it says we're trying to achieve, for example, a 55% reduction in southern New England mid-Atlantic yellowtail flounder. Now, this is what we were trying to achieve in order to get from where we thought we were in 2005 to what the mortality target was for 2006. Now, the reality is that Framework 42 didn't get implemented until almost 2007. So what you see in Table 3 is a comparison of what our targeted reduction was
and what our realized reduction was from 2005 to 2007. Now, you have to be careful here because, once again, 2007 is the terminal year of the assessment. And while GARM 3 included a number of mechanisms to try to make these terminal year estimates more accurate by adjusting for retrospective patterns in a couple of different ways, you know, the reality is we don't know yet if those adjustments worked or not. We don't know when we won't know until we do assessments down the road whether those adjustments really prove to be accurate or enough of adjustment or whatever. But if you look at this table, you see that, okay, our targeted reduction for southern New England, mid-Atlantic yellowtail was 55%, and we got a 51% reduction based on the GARM 3 estimates. For Cape Cod yellowtail was 46%, and we got a 46% reduction. You can see all the others. I think the ones you'll notice that missed, and this will come up again in the next table, which I think is table 4, are some of the offshore stocks like Georges Bank Cod. So in other words, we designed measures in Framework 42 to achieve specific reductions on these seven stocks, and the reductions they achieved were, I think, in almost every instance, if not all instances, were either very similar to what we wanted or was actually more than what we were trying to target. With the caveat that we really don't know the 2007F is valid yet. And so if that 2007F changes next time we do the assessments, you know, this evaluation might look very different. So then the other thing, if you look in Framework 42, is we tried to estimate, you know, this is, we had mortality targets, but as we all know, effort controls are a very blunt tool. And so when you start designing the effort controls to achieve something on one stock, it may go overboard or go under for another stock. So the other thing that Framework 42 did is we said, okay, here's the results from our closed area model. We're going to, we look at these results and we say, this is the reduction that we think we're going to get. Not what we're trying to get, but this is the reduction that we think the measures are going to get. That's what's shown in Table 4. In other words, for Georges Bank Cod, Framework 42 thought we were going to get about a 9% reduction on Georges Cod. And if you look at the GARM 3 results from 05 to 07, the mortality reduction was larger than that, by a large factor, actually. It was about a 58% reduction on Georges Cod. Now, if you look at this table, I think what you see is that the place where the framework seemed to most consistently underestimate the mortality change from 05 to 07 tended to be for the offshore Georges Bank stocks. And conversely, I think there's at least a couple instances where it seemed to overestimate the mortality reduction on the inshore stocks. So we thought about that a little bit, and one of the problems we have with a closed area model, one of the limitations of the closed area model, is that it cannot incorporate really in any realistic fashion the in-season management actions of the U.S.-Canada area. And so, for example, things like in-season changes in trip limits or closure of the eastern U.S.-Canada area really cannot be incorporated into the model. So I hate to call it a reason because I think it's more a hypothesis or speculation in here that, you know, some of the limitations of the model such as that may be part of the reason for these errors, that the model did not capture the impact of those in-season adjustments, and then where that effort went might have gone inshore, which have led to some errors in some of the other ones. Now, to be real honest with you here, you know, when we went through this whole exercise, our conclusion is that the reality is that given the uncertainties about an effort control system, this is actually pretty good performance here, that we did a pretty good job of designing measures to get a specific reduction and then getting that reduction out of it and estimating what the reductions would be. You know, your mileage may differ. Other people may look at the same set of numbers and reach a different conclusion. But given all the uncertainties in the management implementation and the design of the effort control measures in the closed area model, our conclusion from doing all this exercise was that, you know, it actually does a pretty good job, And based on its performance in Framework 42, and in Framework 42, we went back and looked at the performance for Amendment 13 as well. That's all in the Framework 42 document. We concluded that, you know, on the whole, it does a pretty good job given the limitations that we've identified in the past, and it's worth doing the same type of approach for the design of measures in this action.
Yeah, I think just to clarify a little bit what Tom was alluding to with their when he said these are based on different models sometimes, an important point here is these tables, it's a little bit of comparing apples and oranges, because the selectivity pattern of the fishery has changed from what was done for GARM 2 and Framework 42 versus the selectivity pattern of the fishery that was used in the GARM 3 models. And so to compare an F from the past with an F that was just computed is a little bit of apples and oranges, because it depends. You really have to not just look at the F estimate, but consider what sizes and ages of fish are actually being taken. So it's a little more complicated than just comparing the two columns.
Okay. I wanted to thank Tom and Jim. I think this is an important exercise for us to walk through, because it's very illustrative of the problems we have. One of the reasons some of these numbers changed the way they changed is because the BMSYs changed in GARM 3, and consequently the rebuilt TAC, if you will, changed as well. So you could have a case where, let's say we use Gulf of Maine cod, the BMSY in GARM 2 was around 88,000 tons. Now it's 55 or something like that. Consequently, the fully rebuilt target TAC is much smaller, because it's roughly 20% of the rebuilt number when it's rebuilt. So even though you started out to the good, because the baseline shifted in the middle, you actually ended up not as good as you would hope for. So it's very illustrative of the problems we have in when the baselines keep shifting, that we design something based on the baseline as we know it at the time, and then 3 years down the road or some period down the road, the baseline shifts, and we're either to the good or the bad, no matter how well we did, because the baseline shifted. And I think that's a really important point, because it illustrates the dilemma that we're in sometimes.
This might be a good point to throw in an additional uncertainty in this method that, you know, can lead you a little bit astray, at least. And I think it's somewhat lucky, I guess, because it's an example everybody's familiar with, and that it's Gulf of Maine cod. You know, if you look at Table 2 for Gulf of Maine cod, we thought we were going to get a pretty large change in mortality between 04 and 05, and if you notice, it doesn't look like we got a change. And I recognize Jim's point that we're not necessarily comparing the same F, so it's a little bit of apples and oranges. But when we insert the catch into a projection model to get an estimate of F in 2005, of course, all the assumptions that went into that projection produced our estimate of the 2005 F. If you go back in GARM 2, you know, one of the assumptions that may have had a fairly large impact on this case with Gulf of Maine cod is that at the time, I think it was, and I might not have the year right, but I think it was the 2003 year class, was believed to be a fairly large year class. And so that was feeding into the assessment projection and said, in essence, that you can catch a lot of fish in 2005 and the F will still be low. When we now know, you know, 4 or 5 years later, that 2003 year class did not turn out to be as large as was initially assumed. And so that, in part, may partially explain why this catch estimate of 2005, even though the catch looked right, pretty close, generated an F that turns out to be higher than what we expected it to have been. Now, There's other problems, as Jim pointed out. The Fs are not really the same types of Fs. But you also have to consider that, okay, if your recruitment assumption was wrong going into that projection, or wrong, or that may be, I'm not trying to be pejorative, but if your recruitment assumption was an error, then, you know, that introduces additional uncertainty into this particular approach to trying to figure out what you need to do.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Tom, thank you very much for these data tables. They're very helpful. They do illustrate that with certain caveats, we were quite successful in getting to where we needed to be relative to the expected catches, the drops in catches that we wanted to achieve. Table 7, I need you to help me understand the last column in that table, and let me give one example, and that's Gulf of Maine codfish. Let me give you my interpretation and tell me how I need to understand why the minus 21% is there. That is the percent change in F necessary to achieve the F rebuild. I see that the F rebuild is 0.282. That's the fourth column over. And, of course, 07 fishing mortality was quite high, 0.456. All right, and we work across to the right. We see 2007 catch. We see the estimated PDT 2008 catch of 8,028. And then we see the 2009 estimated catch. Is that the 2009 estimated catch at F rebuild? Because that's the way it's worded in Table 3 of the GARM document. It proceeds in that direction to give us a feel for what is going to happen and what would be the 2009 catch with F rebuild.
Well, you picked a good example because this is the exception to the rule.
Well, the okay. Gulf of Maine codfish is always on my mind, so
no,
let's go with the exception to the rule.
Okay.
So my assumption...
Let me explain the table a little bit. The 2009 estimated catch is the catch that the projection says we should get in 2009 if we're fishing at the mortality that we need to be fishing at. Now, I worded it like that on purpose because in the case of a rebuilding stock, you've got really two choices. That could be the result of fishing at the rebuilding fishing mortality rate, or, as is the case with Gulf of Maine cod, the rebuilding F is actually above FMSY. Well, that constitutes overfishing. So in that case, the catch in 2009 is the catch that you expect to get fishing at FMSY of 0.237. And the reduction in the last column is the reduction from 2008 to the FMSY of 0.237. And you can identify those stocks. I think there's only two of them in the table. At least on my copy, it works out pretty well that the F rebuild is in a lighter font than the FMSY. It's kind of grayed out a little bit.
Okay.
But the bottom line is if F rebuild is greater than FMSY, we did the calculation at FMSY.
Okay.
So I think the two examples that I can see are Gulf of Maine cod and Place.
Okay, so
and you might look at that and say, well, how can that happen? I mean, how can F rebuild be higher than FMSY? It's a function of, you know, what recruitment stream is coming in large measure.
Okay, it is a bit hard to follow. But anyways, at a low, relatively low FMSY value of 0.237, lower than the F rebuild of 0.282, and certainly far lower than the 2007 fishing mortality, we can expect to have in 2009 10,327 metric tons as the catch. And that pertains, that's what we would get if we fished at FMSY. And then the next column shows that in 2008, the plant development team believes that the mortality rate actually was 0.30. Okay, 0.30. Therefore, if we're 0.30 in 2008, and we need to get to 0.237 in 2009, that translates into a 21% cut in F. But even with a 21% cut in fishing mortality, we can expect to have increased catch in 2009 relative to 2008. That's what caught my attention. I thought that this would translate into 2009 catch that would be lower we'd have to shoot for a catch that would be lower than the 2008 value of 8,021. But no, it's about 2,300 metric tons more catch we can expect in 2009 relative to 2008. So with that understood, how do you reconcile that with the need to cut by 21%? You see what I mean? We can have more catch, but we have to cut F by 21%. I haven't figured that one out yet.
Well, this happens all the time in our effort control system. I mean, it happens all the time. And all you have to do is look at 2007 and 2008 catches. All right, we have basically made no management measure changes from 2007 to 2008. Right? And yet catch appears, and this is an estimate, to have gone up by nearly, or we expect catch will go up by nearly 3,000 metric tons with no changes in measures at all. And this is in part because catch rates have gone up. It could also be in part because more leasing activity has gone on. I don't know, you know. But anyway, this reflects that. And so under the effort control system, you know, what we're trying to do is to keep the effort down so that the catches don't exceed this 10,300 ton level. We would expect that if we did nothing from 2008 to 2009, that I don't have the number in front of me, but that we would expect that, you know, the fishing mortality is going to be somewhere about 0.3. We wouldn't expect it to change too much, and the catches would probably be more than 10,000 tons.
All right, that's the key point. Catch
now, I'm going to use this to do a backward segue into page 6 of the advisory panel's report. And this is kind of what the advisory panel is talking about. When people start to look at these numbers, they start asking these questions about, well, you know, what are you talking about? Why are you talking about a reduction when it looks like catch can go up? And this relates to our current choice of management controls where we're talking effort controls. And, you know, so the advisory panel is sort of asking the question, you know, what is the council really planning to do out here in the future? Is the council really planning to switch to some sort of hard tack quota monitoring individual quota system program? Or is the council intending to continue where you have a mix where sectors and maybe some other areas are under quotas and then other parts of the fishery are under an effort control system? And these are the types of things that are driving their questions. They're looking at this and they're saying, you know, the reality is that we can increase Gulf of Maine cod catches. You know, so if we're going to do it with effort control, through an effort control system, however, you've got to restrict effort so that the catches don't shoot past that 10,000-ton level.
All right. So the key point is that Gulf of Maine codfish is showing an increase in abundance due primarily to one particular year class. Therefore, whatever effort is out there, it's likely to result in a greater catch per effort. And with that increased catch per effort, we see that 10,327 metric tons is likely to occur. But left to its own devices, that is, with no further restrictions, it's likely that the fishery will take far more than 10,327 metric tons, and that needs to be prevented. And to do that, we have to implement measures that will cut fishing mortality by 21%. Yeah, it seems counterintuitive, but I can appreciate it.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is, I hadn't intended to bring it up just now. I was going to wait until after Tom was done, but he referenced what I wanted to reference on the GAAP report, pages 5 and 6. It says, they also commented that the council had not made a clear decision on its future path for groundfish management. While many assumed that the council was moving towards a quota or catch limit based system, the reality was that there was not any formal decision expressing that plan. This complicates not only Amendment 16 development, but industry planning for the future. And I think that this morning's discussion just builds on to exactly what Tom said there. And I think that what we've got here is the appearance, particularly this morning, of floundering about. And it gives an opportunity for people to introduce obfuscation and obstruction to the process. So I think that right now we need a statement from the council, a clear statement of direction or principal intent as to just what our goals are and where we intend to go with this. And we need this to clarify the issue to stakeholders and to the agency as well about just exactly where we plan to go. So I would like to offer a motion. And the motion would be, it is the intent of the New England Fishery Management Council to manage all fisheries by science and to move all fisheries toward quota-based LAPP management. And I'd like to, if that gets a second, I would like to discuss a little more fully.
There's a second. Mark Gibson. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. Yesterday's discussion, or day before yesterday's discussion on ICAT, I found instructive because it's a fishery that we haven't managed directly, so it gave the council an opportunity to look at something without having a dog in the fight. And first of all, I want to express my thanks to the council for what you people came up with what I began with. The ICAT is extremely difficult to understand, and I'm fairly new at it. But the bottom line is that what we came up with was a recommendation to ICAT that the management be science-based and by some sort of fair quota. And that just makes a whole lot of sense to me. And I think that we need to just focus in on just what it is we're doing on this issue that we've gotten so, to use Tommy Hill's old expression, wrapped around the axle on. We can't be continuing to put lipstick on the old pig. The days at sea management is dying, and the faster we put a bullet in it, the better. And I think that right now we need to make some clear statement of intent so that we aren't getting into these kinds of discussions, and so that we can just say once and for all that this is the direction we're going, and offer for people like Tom and like the Gap some direction to go by, some compass. We need to have a compass in the pilot house of this boat. So I'm open to any suggestions on how to alter this, but that's where I think we should go. Thank you.
Mark Gibson, did you want to comment? You were the seconder.
I seconded it, you know, for the discussion. I don't know that it needs a second. I mean, I think it's we're obligated. I mean, we needed the motion. We're obligated to manage based on best available science. I think the second part of it's the more important one, and I'm understanding that that's where we're likely to be going for 2010. So I wanted to hear what Dave had to say, and wanted to hear some discussion about the time frame. And we're talking about facing an interim action, and we just looked at the time schedule that Tom put up there for Amendment 16, which ambitiously gets us in place for May 1st, 2010. Was that? So I guess what David is saying here is this what he wants it to look like. And that's fine with me.
Anyone else on the council? Jim Odlin.
I guess I'm a little confused because I don't think we have anything in Amendment 16 that's an LAPP-based management system. And what does this mean? Do we have to go back and start Amendment 16 over and make sure we get an LAPP-based management system into that? So I guess I'm looking for some clarification on that.
Dave?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I purposely didn't put any time on it. Because what this is not a statement of any time limits. It's a statement of just where we are moving toward. And I that's why I use the expression move in that direction. It doesn't relate specifically to any time limit on Amendment 16. We have to do what we have to do. In fact, yesterday we had, or day before yesterday, we had the discussion on herring. And when the vote was taken to not go into an ITQ program, I could see that there was great reluctance around here, certainly great reluctance with me, to vote in that way. But we did it out of a pragmatic sense of what we really need to do within certain given time limits. But I think we need to be clear that that to the extent that we can and when we can, that this is the direction that the council is moving. It's just what this is for is to set a compass. It's not to set a time schedule. That was the intent.
Tom Neese.
Yeah, I guess I just got a little bit of a question on a motion and a process question. This particular agenda item today is specifically to talk about Groundfish Amendment 16, and this particular motion appears to be intended to reflect council intent for all fisheries management plans. And, you know, we haven't given any advance notice, for example, to the monkfish fishery or any of the other fisheries, and I doubt many of those stakeholders in the room are, I'm not sure all those stakeholders are in the room who may want to comment on some sort of statement of intent like this.
That's a fair comment, Tom, but I think we're going to entertain some more discussion. This motion may ultimately get whittled down and be specific to groundfish. Sally McGee.
Yeah, I hope that we can actually give some much-needed clear direction back to the committee on this, because we keep just going round and round down in the weeds on the Days at Sea system that I think the council needs to clearly state for the public and for direction to the committee that the intent is to get away from the Days at Sea system. While there might be relics of it that remain through Amendment 16, that the overarching goal, as stated originally in the purpose of Amendment 16, was to implement at least a process for establishing catch limits and accountability measures. And I think that I'm assuming that the intent of this motion was to give that direction. I think it would be more appropriate, perhaps, just to say in the context of the groundfish fishery, since that's what we're talking about today, is just groundfish, maybe not to say LAPP management, but just toward quota-based management, in terms of following the lead of what staff has said, that there is a need for clear guidance back to the committee if the committee is going to get out of this down in the weeds for days on end and actually have some clear guidance that is so sorely needed from the council back to the committee. So I offered a couple of suggestions. I'd be interested to hear what other people think about the motion. I think clearly the maker of the motion is open to friendly amendments in order to give some much-needed guidance back to the committee.
Dave.
Yeah, I think both points are well taken. We can just chop LAPP right off of it. That I don't have a problem with that at all. We're heading in the general direction of quota-based management. That seems to be what the council is intending to do. Also, in answer to what Tom said, I'm willing to withdraw this and put it before the executive committee for further development. However the council wants to proceed with it, but I think that we do need to set some kind of a compass on what the general direction of our management is. I think that there's been too much floundering about and continuing to put lipstick on an old pig, and I think we need to do something of this sort. Whatever people want to do with it, that's where I think we should go.
Rip Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to make a language suggestion, and that maybe just taking the LAPPs off of it gets us there, but I think the philosophy of that the council is a direction in the council is moving away from input management regimes to output management regimes, and whether for this purpose we make it more specific to Amendment 16. I think that Sally's concern, and it's true, I think we get down in the weeds on a lot of issues, but I'm not sure that this will eliminate the fact that we have to deal with days at sea under Amendment 16, because it is going to be part of it. It is part of it at this point in time,
and I think we're forced to deal with it. But I don't disagree with the concept that we need, you know, we need direction. We need to be giving, making a public statement on what the direction of the council is so that people within the industry can plan and move in that direction.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you. The broad scope of the original motion gave me a wee bit of angst. I think the deletion of lapse makes it a whole lot easier to think about this point. I do think we need to further specify to Amendment 16 and then perhaps expand it to the rest of our work after we wade away through that.
So, a question for Tom. The gap report, Tom, the section that you referenced, I guess at the top of page 6, starts at the bottom of 5, and could you just put a little more meat on the bone, the statement or the sentence, this complicates not only 16 development, but industry planning for the future. With respect to the Amendment 16 development, could you maybe elaborate a little bit more on how this lack of intent makes things complicated for you on your end and for us here at the council?
Well, I want to be clear that this is a groundfish advisory panel report, not a PDT or staff report. So, you know, this report reflects what the groundfish advisory panel is saying. That's all it does. I don't want people to say that this is necessarily a staff recommendation or a PDT recommendation because we really haven't addressed this particular issue. But, you know, what happens, what was going on at the groundfish advisory panel meeting is they were discussing a lot of questions related to future development. They were discussing discussing an industry revitalization plan, which is another form for a buyback, I think. And as they were having these discussions, there were many people. It was kind of split at the table. There is at least one advisor who's a firm supporter of the Days at Sea effort control system. I'm not sure he was there at this part of the discussion. But there were other advisors who were going, you know, the council's moving towards quotas. And, you know, I asked the question, show me a council decision that says that's what they're doing. And there isn't one. And so as this discussion was going on, you had the people who felt that there had been the council was clearly moving to quotas. There were other people who really don't want to move to quotas, believe in the effort control system. And, you know, so there was some confusion about whether the council is or is not. And I think from the advisor's point of view, how this plays into Amendment 16 is in relation to some of the monitoring requirements that are under development. You might have different monitoring requirements, but also perhaps in how much time you spend on finessing the effort control system. You know, if you think this is going to be a short-term effort control system that is very soon going to turn into a quota-based system, you might simplify things. I think this was the thinking of the advisors. It might also affect how people make decisions on what they support in Amendment 16. There are other advisors besides Maggie who are at the meeting who may be willing to address this, you know, when and if you open up to this particular motion. So they may be able to explain it a little more clearly than I did.
Thanks, Tom. I do plan to go to the audience. I just note it's not in our binders today, but the purpose and needs section of the amendment, this amendment, Amendment 16, refers continually to measures to reduce effort, including days at sea reductions, trip limit reductions, area closures. Of course, we know we have to implement ACLs and AMs. Adjust effort controls as necessary to reduce fishing mortality. Adjust effort control programs for non-sector vessels. There's reference to the requirements of EFH. So Tom's right. The council's never made a decision that it is moving towards hard quotas, and when you take a look at the document that we're creating, it's very clear up until now that the primary way to do what it is we need to do is going to be achieved through effort controls. And as to how many people are going to join a sector is anyone's guess at this point, because there's some outstanding issues, one of which or two of which we dealt with today, and we're going to continue to talk about those. So it's very difficult for staff and for the industry to know which camp they want to be in, whether they want to stay in a day-at-sea system and continue to refine the system, or if it's much better for them to jump into a sector. So, and I'm sure from the services side of things, there may be advantages or disadvantages to one system over another, but not knowing which direction we're going and continually having one foot on the brake and one foot on the gas makes things difficult for planning and administrative purposes. A lot of repairs, yeah. Okay, I had Dr. Pierce.
Well, the motion as perfected certainly is far better than the first motion, where we are specific to lapse management, because for all species, it would be inappropriate for us to act today on that particular motion, I would think. But the second one also presents some problems for me, and that the first part of the motion is doesn't really add anything to the discussion, because we do manage by science now, hopefully good science, so it doesn't seem to be very instructive or useful in terms of giving guidance to anybody, certainly not to those we manage. And then to move all species towards quota-based management, again, it's not about groundfish species. It goes beyond groundfish species. This is about Amendment 16. This discussion has gotten off track from Amendment 16, I suspect. And to move all species toward, that doesn't give much direction either regarding Amendment 16, because If that's what the maker of the motion wants to do, make a statement regarding Amendment 16, and that everyone that will be managed through Amendment 16 will be managed through a quota, through a hard quota, then say that, as opposed to move all species towards. That might mean 5 years from now we'd be managing all species with quota based. The motion is unclear to me, and as a consequence of that, I would move to postpone indefinitely.
Is there a second? Jim Odlin. All those in favor, raise your hand. 5. Opposed? 10. Abstentions? 2. Motion fails. 5-10-2. Sally McGee.
Yeah, if we could just go back to the original motion, I think people have been saying, okay, we need to focus on groundfish. I think the word groundfish needs to appear in the motion. Get rid of all species and replace it with groundfish. And there was some discomfort with saying quota-based management, and there was a suggestion by the committee chair to say toward output-based management, which I think recognizes something that the committee has not truly faced, and that is, like I said before, Magnuson has changed. So, yes, relics of days at sea are going to remain in the groundfish plan. We can give clear direction back to the committee that the focus needs to be the big picture, overarching output-based management approach that we unfortunately avoid and have wasted a lot of time trying to make the broken system work. So I would suggest those changes based on the discussion that has just taken place.
Is that a motion to amend or substitute?
No, well, those are suggested as friendlies.
Dave.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. I think that the immediate problem is what needs to be solved, and that's groundfish. I was trying to make it a little more general, but the immediate problem certainly is groundfish. Let's see. As far as what Dr. Pierce said, we are bound by law to manage by science. I just put that in as a reaffirmation. If it would be preferable to take it out of this motion, that's fine. To move ground fish toward outpost put base management. That does what we need to do right now. I still stand by the idea that we should be making a general statement of intent, but this is probably not the day to do it, because as has been pointed out, I think Tom pointed out, that there are other stakeholders that would need to be involved in this discussion, and it probably goes beyond what we have in our schedule for today, anyway, in the agenda. So I'm a little reluctant to take quota-based out of it. I'm not sure I want to do that. I want to leave quota-based in there. If Sally wants to make a motion to amend, that's fine. And if Dr. Pierce would like to remove the science-based, that's fine, too.
Second or agree with the changes? Okay. Paul Howard.
Just kind of remind the council that I think it was a year or two ago that they passed a policy on not so much the direction, but it was a policy that basically said that when we manage our fisheries, we'll make sure our plans have a high degree of meeting our mortality objectives. So there was it was called a conservation and allocation policy, and that the council also felt it better start allocating, because one size doesn't fit all, and there were some groups that were benefiting over others. So there was a policy approved by the council and talked about by any number of advisors and stuff that said the council should start conserving better and allocating. So I don't see anything in there that talks about allocating. It may be inherent, but I think you ought to say it. If it, you know, quota-based management might just mean we're going to set a hard tack and that's it. But, you know, what's the next step? Do you want to allocate for those reasons you talked about before or not? Because that's kind of key in letting the public know where you're going.
Let me make a general comment on the motion. As it's written, it has no direct effect on Amendment 16 because of the inclusion of the word toward. As was pointed out by previous speakers, it's just the sort of, we're going to get there, but there's no direct tie back to Amendment 16, which, you know, it's a policy decision. If the council wants to make a statement that strong and say, yes, in Amendment 16, we're going in this direction, I just throw that out there. Dave.
Yeah, thank you, John. The problem is that we have to look at the reality of the issue, and we're not going to shoot the pig before Amendment 16 is done. Amendment 16 is going to include some days at sea management. I'm not sure how I would word that, but if we said it's the intent, then I think we're all right, but I don't think we can say that the council is clearly going to eliminate days at sea in Amendment 16, because we're not. That's just the reality of it. So I'm not sure if that gets at what you're saying.
I just offer a perspective that I agree that the way the document's structured now, there's a inclusion of days at sea and, in fact, a reliance on them for input effort control. You can still have days at sea and an output-based mortality control system. You can maintain days at sea either in a sector or in a common pool as a way of maintaining the so-called pecking order. But your primary metric for success is still the output or the quota, the TAC. So it's not saying that we're getting rid of days at sea and there'll be no days at sea in the amendment. It's just saying we're not going to rely solely on days at sea to get there, to meet our mortality objectives.
Yeah, what I'm trying to avoid is to get into a discussion that we can't do today because of the way our agenda is set up. And I think that was a valid criticism that Tom made. I'd like to keep it as simple as possible, and just that this is where we want to go. This is our intent. This is our direction. So I think we're getting a little bit not focused, but I think it has to be kept general. I'd like to keep it as general as possible, and just say this is what our intent is, so that we can offer clarity to both the industry and the agency. That's the intent here. Nothing beyond that.
Okay, I'm going to continue to take comment from the council. I'm going to go to the audience as well, and then we're going to have lunch. I'm not going to call the question before lunch. I think people need to think about all of this. So on the council, those that have not spoke, Doug?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was very satisfied with the suggestions that Sally McGee was making to that amendment, and I wish I could have gotten that in there before David had agreed to modify the amendment. I think even though it's inherent in our process that we manage via science, I think it's good to reaffirm that at times. And I do like the idea of making it a little bit more general and broad that we're going to be dealing with output-based management. At this point in time, I won't make a After making those comments, at this point in time, I won't make a substitute motion until I hear from some of the other council members, but I may be prepared to do that shortly after that.
Rodney, and then I have Gene.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't disagree with this, but something here doesn't make sense to me, and it could be just me. It says that it is the intent of the council to manage all fisheries. Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? Isn't that what we have been supposed to be doing for years? I can see moving a ground fishery towards a quota-based management system, but it doesn't make sense the way it's there. Maybe it needs a little bit of change. Pardon? No, it's manage all fisheries. Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing?
Gene.
Just a couple of factors, I think, to help guide this discussion. One is, I think you need to make this motion very clear whether you're intending this to somehow alter the current alternatives that are at play in Amendment 16. There are quota-based management measures already in place in the groundfish plan. Sectors is certainly one. You have some areas that are subject to quota-based management in terms of TACs, et cetera. So I think in order for this to be a meaningful motion, the council should decide, is it meant to give guidance to the groundfish committee to come up with different and more other alternatives that are not already in Amendment 16 or not? And without that kind of specific guidance, it's nothing more than just a sort of a rhetorical statement that has no binding meaning to it.
Jim Odlin.
Well, my comments were very similar to Gene's. This doesn't say anything. To me, does this mean in Amendment 16? And if that's the case, then we have to go back and redo Amendment 16. We've got 2 months left to get it out the door. I think in Amendment 16 we took a vote against having hard TACs somewhere down the road a year or two ago, maybe by now. So I can't support this motion unless it has a lot more specificity on what it means. Thank you.
Well, I agree with most of the comments that have been made. The the motion isn't perfect, and it needs to say what people need it to, what it needs to say before you can really. It's been altered several times already. It's the idea that we're talking about right now, whether or not Amendment 16 is going to continue to maintain an effort control program and a sector program right now. As to the vote the council took in the past on hard tax, that was to not manage the fishery solely by hard TAC only, if I remember the motion properly. We'll follow up, Jim.
My follow-up is if your explanation is that this does give direction to Amendment 16, then I think it needs to be in the motion. And then I can analyze that. But if it's this worded the way it is now, then I don't know what it says. So somebody needs to either get the words in there or something, because to me this doesn't say anything. Thank you.
Three or four people now have said that they could understand it better, agree with it more if it said something, but have failed to amend the motion. So we can do this one of three ways. We can just keep talking about something on the board that nobody seems to understand or want. Somebody can make a motion to amend, and then we can have a discussion about something. Or I can just finish the couple of people on the council, go to the audience, receive comments from them, and then we can go to lunch. You like that idea? Hi, Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, well, my preference is to wait until we get the final decisions from the National Marine Fisheries Service regarding ACLs and AMs, for one thing, because it's relevant to this sort of discussion. And I'll just point out what was already said. I'm on the Ground Fish Committee. If this was to pass, I would have no guidance whatsoever as to how this would proceed. And frankly, if I'm personally looking down the road long-term towards ground fish management, IFQs, ITQs, some form of LAPP. That's the way I'm looking down the road, and I'm not prepared to make those sorts of weighty decisions now, plus perhaps council members, a new council that may be in place not too long down the road may want to go in a different direction. I don't know, because we can't control we can't set the stage for the next council. They can do what they want to do. But anyway, so ACLs, AMs, and no guidance, plus, well, that's why I made the motion to postpone indefinitely, but that didn't pass. So wish it had. We could go to lunch right now.
Dave Gale.
2 points. One was science, which is gone, which has got to come back. But what kind of science? We're going to manage the biological science, political science. We're real good at political science. We, quite frankly, aren't very good at managing the biological science. Not all groups that appear here are created equal. Some people get more biological science. Some try to get less. So I wouldn't support it without it saying specifically biological science. And the second thing I would say is I won't support it for Amendment 16, because I don't think you can get there from here in the time you got left. I would support it for moving towards ground fish, towards quota-based management post-Amendment 16. I wanted to say that. So I think the best thing to do here at some point is to go to lunch, let the makers of the motion see if they can figure out how to word it to satisfy the needs I've heard around the table, and bring it back up as an amended motion after lunch.
Go to the audience for a few comments, and then we're going to break for lunch. Peter?
Thank you. I'm Peter Baker with the Pew Environment Group. I think what the agency needs, what the industry needs, what the public needs, what the staff needs, what the committee needs, is to hear the council say, we're moving away from day-to-day management, and we're going towards sector management in Amendment 16. And the people need to start preparing for that and making those decisions, instead of people wondering, is there going to be another huge cut in days at sea coming? And are we going to keep in this downhill slide of cut days, cut days, cut days, cut triplets, cut triplets, cut triplets? So I'd encourage you to be more specific. Move towards sectors in Amendment 16. I think that's the way to go. Thank you.
Maggie?
Maggie Raymond. It's difficult to comment on the motion because, as the council members have said, I don't understand what the motion says, so I would just like to reserve the right when it's finally in its final form to speak to it again. I will say, in response to the comment that was just made, that the council needs to keep in mind, if you are going to move towards quota-based management in Amendment 16, and you're characterizing that as sectors for Amendment 16, there are a whole lot of people who are not signed up for a sector. Okay, so it's not, sectors are voluntary. People don't have to take those people who aren't signed up, and we need to develop a system that works for them as well. We can't just assume that they're all going to jump into a sector, because some of them just won't do that. And we also don't know what we still don't know what the rules are going to be for sectors. So it's, you know, the people who are even signed up for them now aren't certain about what the final rules are going to be. So we obviously can't eliminate an effort control system from Amendment 16. We're stuck with that no matter what for the common pool. And for anybody else who decides that they don't like the ultimate sector rules and decides to stay in the common pool, we can't turn the common pool into a cesspool. We have an obligation to make that the best possible thing that it can be for those people who do not want to be in sectors. Thank you.
John Williamson.
John Williamson, Ocean Conservancy and Groundfish AEP member. And I must say this motion is something of a Rorschach test aspect to it, and that people can read a lot of different things into it. But I think this is a very worthwhile discussion. So I can say what I read into it, and is that, well, I should start off saying it was very impressive listening to the PDT report this morning, and knowing that, having watched the closed area model evolve over a 10-year period, that the PDT has been working with it, constantly retuning it, perfecting it to try to achieve more exact results in management actions by increasing the predictability of the model. But the model has some obvious limits, and the limits are based upon the limits of working with a days at sea system. We're working with an input control system. So it's actually very impressive that the model, the performance of the model, the analysis that we got this morning was a performance evaluation for the model, and it's working pretty well as far as predictability, but it only gets you so far. And that's the frustration that this council has with groundfish management. So in this motion, I read a few things. I read that if this passes, that there's a commitment to greater accountability in groundfish management. There's a commitment to creating a more responsive management system and a more responsive approach to managing groundfish, something where it doesn't take months and months and months and a lot of process to create a change, and that those changes can happen much more quickly and be much more responsive to changes in resource condition. I read a commitment to greater management uncertainty. Excuse me, to greater management certainty. It's that buffer zone between ACL and ACT that we're talking about in National Standard 1, and it's the analysis that needs to be done as to whether the actions that are being taken are going to get you where you want to go with some fair amount of predictability. And then finally, that there is a commitment to creating greater predictability in groundfish management than we've seen over the last 10 years. And that leads to greater stability for the industry, more predictability for people's business planning. So, I mean, that might be a lot for me to read into this motion. It's a Rorschach test, but I think that's where this council is headed. Thank you.
Peter Shelley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really glad this topic is being brought up. I think the statement in the GAP report that the industry is really at sea as to where the council is going is a very, very troubling statement at this time. I think it's very important for the council to show leadership. Many of you have been in this in groundfish fisheries for your whole lives. You know what the public is looking for. It's looking for leadership from the council, not a finger up in the wind to see where the political winds are carrying at the moment. I think, John, you said that this is like having your foot on the brake and the accelerator. I think it's more like trying to get to second base while keeping your foot on first base. You can't make it. We see Amendment 16 as a really critical opportunity to move this fishery toward where it has to go, which is greater accountability, and something along the lines of this motion are the minimum that are needed. We would like to see a stronger statement to have Amendment 16 be used to move the fishery as close to quota-based management as is possible. We think there are just so many problems. There's no question that the staff and the council have gotten much better at predicting how the indirect controls are going to work. But I think it really is hurting the fishery in two ways. In some ways, it's leaving a lot of fish in the water that could be caught under a quota system. And so that's hurting economically. I think in other cases, it is catching fish as bycatch and discards that shouldn't be caught. And so it's hurting your conservation objectives. I really strongly urge that you go forward. And the other opportunity is if the council acts boldly on this sort of question, the council will have to look at directly and publicly the allocation effects and the social economic impacts of going to a quota-based system and make some decisions about how the fishery should look in 15 or 20 years with respect to different states, with respect to small operators, big operators. And I think Amendment 16, if it go forward without having a strong statement like this, will continue to muddle that issue, and the allocation issue will get taken it will happen at the docks, and you won't have to feel any accountability for it, but it certainly will happen. So Amendment 16 is the opportunity to move to quota-based management, and I urge the council to make a strong statement that it intends to do so. Thank you.
Vito.
Peter Gigliani, North East Seafood Coalition. For the sake of expediency, I think the sooner that this topic gets done, I don't think it's going to offer, as far as we're concerned, it's not going to offer a lot of guidance to the industry. We're already there, I think. Just to remind everyone, this is like deja vu. I mean, this time 2 years ago, the council put a bold statement out there that we want to move to output-controlled management and put scoping out and solicited the industry for ideas, and we dropped those from this amendment. There were a bunch of ideas, and they got dropped because of time, because we wanted to do a good job on a common pool and a good job on sectors. And now we're losing time from the PDT report, which was heading down a road that was very interesting to us, and the concern of not knowing about the dual management system that's coming up, not knowing, as the chairman said, what the enrollment ratio is going to be sectors to common pool in 2010. We're losing our market right now. In fact, there are people in the industry that are now admitting we've lost our market for groundfish, pretty much. We're supplemental, which is very, very scary, because that's going to put a higher demand on the resource to produce the same amount of money. The lost yields, I agree with Peter Shelley on the output. We're looking at outputs now because the closed area model has done a fantastic job when it was managing two or three stocks and everything else went along for the ride. The weakest link management, I mean, we successfully predicted the reductions in mortality on the three or four stocks, but we're not talking about, if you look at the TACs that were laid out in Framework 42, enormous loss of yield, exactly what was predicted. The CAM predicted huge losses of yield, and that's a result of the input control system the way we're doing it. We're not going to have time to develop a full output control system beyond the choice of sectors, but I think the consideration now of using outputs in with the along with the input control system, like we do in U.S. Canada, trip limit triggers. The only thing limitation we have right now is to give NIMS the support and of being able to implement those strategies, to be able to do like we do in U.S., Canada, and SAPs. There's your output, and most of the people are going to be on days at sea in 2010. We do see that. But we just hate to lose valuable time talking about, you know, just going along with the results of having a closed area model forfeit 60, 70, 80% yields in some of these TACs. There's no retrospective pattern that I'm aware of that's going to be built in to the closed area model's method of doing things. There were very high TACs in the past, and we'd catch half of those and still find out that it was a good thing we only caught half of those because the closed area model got closer. So because of the retrospective patterns, it makes the closed area model look like it did a better job of predicting things. But the reality is it chopped catch dramatically from what the TACs were. Now we have retrospective patterns built in. The TACs are lower. Are we going to adjust the closed area model to make sure that it doesn't do that again so that it doesn't use those already adjusted TACs and we end up forfeiting even more yield? We've lost our market. Any more loss of yield is going to be a killer. Start looking at the blend now of using outputs like we do in U.S. Canada and like we do in the SAPs and get NIMS up to speed on monitoring most of the species that way. Thank you.
Jen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jennifer Littoral, Island Institute, and I'm also here to speak on behalf of the Mid-Coast Fishermen's Association, who couldn't be here today. Very pleased to see your discussion this today. We're all looking for some clarity in Amendment 16. A lot of efforts and money and time are being spent on working in new management systems in 2010, and to know that we're moving in the right direction and spending those resources to get there, we need the clarity from here to know that we're moving and doing things in the right direction. Thank you.
Reggie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can't believe that we're still yapping about this. But I just want to share with the council, if I may, a letter that I wrote to our local media and media up and down the coast. And it goes as follows. Our fisheries management system is wasteful. The regulations actually force fishermen to throw overboard huge quantities of valuable fish. Last year, because of regulations, more than 50% of the cod that were caught had to be thrown back dead. This is a sin. Particularly given the financial condition of the fishing industry and the need to conserve our stocks. We have all read over the past decade that the fishing industry is in trouble financially and that the vessels will be out of business if the system doesn't change immediately. But we have had huge reductions in our fleet from about 1,000 vessels to about 575 vessels in the last 15 years. During that same period, landers of ground fish have been well below 50%, but the reduction was done gradually, and fishermen, being very creative, did what they had to do to adjust to the cuts. And now we are anticipating further cuts that this time are certain to cripple the economic structure of Massachusetts and of the other states that are concerned in this fishery. We can point the fingers on who to blame for this current crisis, but that will not get the job done. Just like the banking crisis we are all going through now, let's not focus on the blame and rather focus on the remedy. And there will have to be one remedy, because a disease with many remedies will never be cured. However, remedies are available. I support the concept of sector allocation along with many others. This will provide incentives to maximize both our catch and the conservation of the fish stocks. If we put in place an emergency action now to implement harsh regulations, we will lose small businesses and compromise our fishing industry. We need to put everything on hold and put in place the conservation-friendly sector management. That's why I support Congressman Frank and my state delegation proposal for the one-year delay, even though we're in some type of delay right now, on implementing Amendment 16. The delay must be real, a real delay, and not include any actions to cut the fleet in these economical perilous times. Such a delay will have a minimal effect on the stocks, because not one stock will go extinct in 1 year, and give us time to put in place a more rational, less wasteful fishery management system. Let's all work together to sustain our communities. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Eric?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Eric Brazier, Hook Fishermen's Association. I applaud Dave Preble for putting this motion up and getting the ball rolling, and I only wish that he or someone else had come up with this months, if not years ago. We've seen this before. You know, how many months did we talk about sectors and start delving into the details of sectors and sector management before we actually defined what a sector is? You know, how can we arrive at a solution if we can't agree on what the solution looks like? We need a vision. We need a plan. We needed it then. We need it now more than ever. You know, we need to move away from this ineffective system. We need to have reliable data. We need to be able to set appropriate trip limits. And we need to live within them. And we need to be held accountable if we don't. It's pretty clear the direction that we're going, but we need to codify that. We need to put it down. We need to agree, or agree to disagree in many cases, that this is the direction we're moving in, and move in that direction. The time has passed for quibbling and squabbling. We know where we need to go. We need to agree on where we need to go, or agree to disagree, and move on.
Anyone else? All right. It's 12:15. Come back from lunch at 1:30. We'll resume. Before we left, we had a motion on the board. I think it's there, just the board's not lit up.